Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Dan Snow's History. Earlier this month, I received some very sad news, and that is that the last surviving original member of the SAS, Mike Sadler, died. He was 103 years old. Many of you will have seen him depicted in the hit television series SAS Rogue Heroes. He was a dashing young man. He was a master of desert warfare, a great navigator. And Mike, in real life, was a dashing, fantastic navigator. His particular role was guiding the columns of SAS troops and vehicles through hundreds of miles of desert behind enemy lines in North Africa. I was lucky enough to meet Mike. I went to his house in 2016. He was so welcoming. We had a lovely chat. He showed me some fantastic photos, clippings, bits of stuff in his scrapbook that I'll never, ever forget. He was so softly spoken, so generous, so gentle. It's hard to believe that he was once a member of this tough, elite unit of mavericks, of warfighters, who helped to turn the tide of the war in North Africa. So I want to take this opportunity now to reshare the episode in which I talked to Mike Sadler. He told me all about how he joined the unit and what life was like in the SAS during the Second World War. It's one of my favourite interviews. He was such an ambassador for the greatest generation, and he's one of the last. This is a tribute to him.
T-10.
The atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima.
God save the king.
No black-white unity till there is first and black unity.
Never to go to war with one another again.
And liftoff. And the shuttle has cleared the tower.
How did you come to serve in North Africa during the Second World War?
Well, I was working in Rhodesia at the time and got into the army there and went through up to Somaliland as an anti-tank gunner in those days. And we were then sent up to North Africa, up to Suez, and ended up digging trenches around Merza Matru for defensive places for our two-pounders.
So at that stage, it looked like the Germans were going to go all the way to Suez.
Well, the Germans were at that time in Tobruk, and they were expected to be breaking out and coming down to Alamein. And so we were actually at Merza Matru, which is a bit east of Tobruk. And from there, I did actually get a few days' holiday, and I was in Cairo and met a lot of Rhodesians, and they mentioned the LRDG to me, the Long Range Desert Group, which I had never heard of, and, you know, drinking in various bars. They said, would you like to join? Because they thought they needed an anti-tank gunner, which I happened to be at the time. So I said they told me about the LRDG. It sounded exciting and interesting.
So you joined the LRD, the Long Range Desert Group, the forerunner of the SAS, because you were drinking in the right bars.
That's right, yes. It wasn't actually the forerunner, because the SAS was at the time forming up in, although I didn't know that either, it was being formed by David Stirling down in the Canal Zone. And so I've joined the LRDG, which had just started not very long before. And the headquarters were at the time in Kufra, in southern Libya. And it was quite a journey from Cairo, because eventually they kindly accepted me and I was transferred. And on the journey down to Kufra, I was so fascinated to see they had to shoot the stars and so on to find out where we were. And I sat up with them during the night to see what they did. And when we got to Kufra, the first thing I found out, I was joining a Rhodesian patrol in Kufra, and the first thing they said when I arrived was, would you like to be a navigator? And I thought, oh yes, that was I never looked at another anti-tank gun after that. So I became a navigator, and I learned the business in a fortnight in Kufra, and then went out on a patrol. And from then on, I was a navigator in the LRDG.
And what was the job of the LRDG at that point?
It was largely reconnaissance, because nobody knew anything about the desert. And at the time, or rather some time before, it was believed in HQ in Cairo that the deserts were more or less impassable, and that therefore there was no possible threat coming from the Italians at the time down in those parts of Libya. And it was partly a reconnaissance business, and then also they did a road watch where we got up to a long way behind the front line. This was sat on the roadside and recorded what was going up towards the front, and then that was transmitted back at night. Two chaps walked down every night to the roadside and lay behind a suitable bush through the following day, recording what went to and fro on the roads, and which was, as it was the only road going up to the front, it was probably pretty interesting.
Did you ever think, this is a bit hairy, I wish I had my old job back working as a sort of regular artilleryman, or was this it exciting?
No, I didn't really particularly want to be an artilleryman. It was just the only thing that I could get into at the time. No, I had no spare. I wasn't a proper soldier. I was just a wartime soldier. But still, we did get in. And then, as a result of being a navigator in the LRDG, the SAS had a disastrous first experience by parachute, and then they realized that they could get there by land instead. And their first experience was due to the hazards of parachuting in a high wind and in the dark and so on, and or with very little experience. And so the LRDG actually picked up the few survivors, and David Stirling was very keen to do an operation as soon as possible after that, so that his unit wouldn't be wiped out as being a disaster. And so he had managed to arrange for the LRDG to take them to their targets for their first successful operation, and I happened to navigate Paddy Maine, who was the sort of star operator, to the furthest west airfield in Libya, Wadi Tamit, it was called at that time, or Tamit, and which was a successful operation. Although I didn't participate, we only got them there and brought them home again.
But you were a star, a navigator, going by the stars, like a ship across an ocean.
It was just like being on the ocean, except there weren't the currents to contend with. So, but that the training became useful later when I was sailing. But that I had to add to the knowledge by learning about the tides and currents. But no, it was somewhat similar. Mostly it was a daytime. Colonel Bagnold, who did the groundwork before the war, which gave rise to the LRDG, and he indeed set it up originally. And he had invented or designed a sun compass, a very, very good sun compass, which was much more. The army had a great compass and something like a soup plate with all the ephemera on it, practically. And he produced a very little neat compass with a dial about that size and a needle, a sun compass. So you could set a course on it, and we had a few tables to work out where the sun was at any given moment in the day, and you could set the right setting on it, and then just drive on the shadow, because you had a 360 degrees around the top aligned with the vehicle that you were in. And with the aid of that, you could drive fairly accurately in the daytime, provided that the sun usually was sunny, shining then. And that was all you had to do, really. And then at night, one had to use an aeroplane compass with graticules and things. You could set a course on that. But then it was an awful fiddle because it was totally inaccurate, the compass, because it's so affected by metal in the vehicle and stuff being moved. Or you move a jerry can around the back, it altered the setting on the compass. And so the only way to really use it at night was to get away from the Jeep and line it up with a hand bearing compass. And then you just use the aeroplane compass just merely to maintain the course that it was on.
And what about that first expedition with Blair? Blair Main's one of the legendary figures of World War II in the British Army. What do you remember about him on that first journey?
Well, I didn't know him to start with, but I suppose I didn't really know him anyway, because he was with a little party of his own. We just had him in the jeeps. And no, they were not in the jeep, in the LRDG lorries, rather, which we had at that time. And I thought he was, I was very, very impressed by him. He was a very quiet fellow. Both he and David Stirling were amazingly quiet. They never really raised their voices. They were very quiet.
And they were great leaders.
They were both, yes, they were natural leaders. So David Stirling could get you to do anything, you couldn't refuse. By saying, "Well, Mike, I wonder if you would do this." You feel, "Oh, yes, I said."
And what do you remember about that first operation? That's the first, the SAS's first successful operation. Well, how did it go?
There was the first time we met them. We drove up from Kufra to Jarlo, which was sort of halfway up to the coast, and met this ragged team of survivors. And, well, we were pretty ragged as well, of course. And then we got allocated a team to go to various airfields. And I was lucky enough to get Blair Main. So, yes, that was it. That's where we met. And then we set off on quite a long journey westwards to Temet. I can't remember now how far it was, but I think it was 2 or 3 days. And that part of it was all great fun in those days, because I loved the desert and I loved the navigation. And one was discovering, it was a voyage of discovery, because the maps, except in the very coastal regions, had nothing much on them except longitude and latitude lines and a dotted line with a believed camel track or something like that. So it was entirely like being at sea. And then when we got to Wadi Temet, when it's a very big, long, deep wadi leading up to where the airfield was, and we got down in there and they went off and had a very successful raid. Some disputed parts about it, but it was very successful. I think they put bombs on about 30 aeroplanes there, and believed to be, I think they were confirmed as successes. And that was the most successful of that group of raids, because 2 or 3 people, David went to another one, and there was a third airfield visited, I can't remember, I think Aja Darbia. On that, Jock Lewis, who was a sort of co-founder of the SAS, was hit by a strafing aircraft afterwards. That was the snag about these raids. You always got chased afterwards, and he actually got hit and died. Well, he was killed, in fact. And he was one of the co-founders with David of the SAS, so he was a great loss.
Well, it must have been pretty hairy escaping from those raids. Was it a matter of hiding, or was it a matter of getting out of there as fast as you could?
Well, it was a matter of a combination, because you could get not that far away. I mean, on one of the raids the Fuka or Sidi Anish raid, I was my duty was to go to one corner of the airfield while they drove jeeps around it, shooting up the airfield, shooting up the aircraft, and wait until dawn in case somebody had been lost and they had somewhere to go to where they might be brought back. So I got away from there really at dawn after the raid, and I actually drove through a German column that had set out into the desert to look for us.
What happened then?
Well, I drove through it from the back. Nobody noticed. I don't think they expected anyone to be behind. And they'd stopped to have a cup of tea and stuff on the roadside. And so I drove on and out and luckily joined up with somebody further down. And that was, everything tended to be a bit of luck at the time because we didn't really know what was going on very much. I had one Jeep and another chap, a driver. I was trying to navigate. And about 10 miles further on, we got away from that column. Nobody thought anything of it, I suppose, for a lot of cars driving about. And I saw a fellow on the horizon saying, "Get down, get down." And when we got there, we found that, and we had to lie up for the day there because we couldn't have moved. A load of aircraft came, I can't remember what they were now. I think they were Stukas, or either Stukas or ME-109. And they flew around us. And then flew away again. And we discovered then that there was, over the ridge, there was a German recovery unit collecting wrecked vehicles on the other side of the ridge. So that was why the aircraft didn't bother us. So they probably thought we were part of the same thing.
Was it exciting feeling that you were contributing really tangibly to the war effort rather than just sitting manning the defences in Alam Halfa or somewhere like that?
Yes, it was a nice, it was outdoor life, and it was quite exciting. It was alarming at times. It was quite alarming, and there was a possibility of you being hit by somebody. Yeah, but I wasn't all that keen on being shot or anything. But who was? It was a hard life. I mean, it was very hot. We didn't have enough water or food for quite long periods, that sort of thing. But still, I personally enjoyed it really on the whole. And you forget about the bad bits to some extent. So I can remember the good things like the camping in the evening, and used to get a little a ration of rum and lime last thing in the day to restore our spirit. And if you put it in a plate under one of the cars, the cool breeze blowing would cool it down and make a very nice drink. And that was the sort of thing we remembered with pleasure.
You also had an extraordinary adventure eventually, didn't you? And of escape and evasion. Tell me what happened there.
Oh well, that was when David Stirling was captured. Well, we had a very long journey because I met up with David in Cairo because he was planning this, and he intended to get into southern Tunisia and do an operation possibly on the way through to join up with the First Army, which had landed there, and the Second SAS, who had also landed there.
So they were the Americans?
They were with the Americans, yeah. Yes. There were British there as well.
Right?
No, or were there? I think they were mainly Americans. We certainly joined, and the French weren't there, but they were coming up from Lake Chad. General Leclerc and his army or his division were making their way up from Lake Chad in the south, And there was an SAS unit that David had raised and trained and so on with them. And he wanted, he commissioned me there. He said, I'm in his brother's flat in Cairo. His brother was at the embassy there, and he lived in Cairo, so and had a flat, which David tended to use as his unofficial headquarters. And he'd asked for me to go there to help with some planning on this operation. Halfway through the meeting, he said, "Mike, I need you as an officer." He said, "Go and get yourself some pips." So in the bazaar, that's what I did. We then planned this operation, which was to do a sort of long desert journey through along the inside of Libya to the south of Tunisia. Then we had to go through a narrow gap between the sea and a big salt lake, the Gavez Gap, which was only a few miles wide and was a sort of holding point, a possible front line, and then to do an operation there and join up with his brother give them the benefit of our experience. So it was a long journey. I can't really remember how long, but we had to take some extra jeeps with just petrol and leave them in the desert, having removed any useful bits, in order to get there. And when we met up with the French, with a French SAS unit south of the Gavez Gap, and we were very tired, and eventually, well, at night time, we drove through the Gavez Gap. We drove over, and we suddenly found aeroplanes appearing around us, and we were driving over an airfield that we didn't even know existed. And then early next morning, just first light, we drove through a German unit that was gathering its wits by the roadside again. And on up to, we had to, we hurried on from there as well.
Did you engage them or did you just whiz past?
No, we wasn't. We wanted to get to our destination. So we just whizzed past and drove as far as possible, we thought. So we knew there was a coast road and we knew that there was a route along the south side of the lakes. And we thought that if we divided the angles, you know, get as far as possible away from both sides quickly. What we didn't know was that there was another one which did just that. And anyway, we drove, and you could see some nice hills in the distance as the sun shone, sun rose, and we drove across all sorts of scrubby desert fields, you know, and little huts and things. But we thought we'd get shelter and get some shelter of some kind in these hills, and we finally got there and found a lovely wadi, and went into that. I was in the first vehicle at the time, got navigating so, and drove up the wadi as far as possible. You couldn't go any further, and we stopped there. And then the rest of them stopped all the way down the wadi. And we were absolutely dead, and because it was a long journey and a hard night, no sleep, and so we'd fallen asleep. Johnny Cooper and I were in sleeping bags, and first thing I knew, I was being kicked by someone. I looked up, and there was an Africa Corps fellow, prodding me with his Schmeisser or whatever it was. And kicked me in the. I was in a sleeping bag, and Johnny Cooper was the same. So, but our jeep, we couldn't. There was nothing we could do. They told us to keep lying down in our bags, and they went on a bit down the wadi. I think they were on a recce, we couldn't do anything because our jeep was covered in camouflage, and and tarpaulins and so on. And so we couldn't reach anything, and we had no weapons with us. So we finally, in an instantaneous decision, decided we were either going to go into a POW camp or make a break for it. So we did. And long day. This was sort of, I suppose it was about midday sometime, perhaps a bit later in the afternoon. And Johnny and I and the Frenchman, we'd been allotted a Frenchman from the Lake Chad party. We scarpered up the hillside, and because the other fellows had just gone down to a little corner a few yards further down the wadi. And eventually we managed to hide up on top of the river. We got to the ridge more dead than alive and managed to hide in a little narrow wadi, and was lucky enough to have a goat herder come round with his goats and all round our area. So I think they did look for us, and because they knew we'd got away. And oddly enough, a little while ago, I got an account from somebody, I've forgotten who, of a German unit that claimed to have been involved in capturing David. In it, there was a little description of this by the chap who wrote it, of kicking a man in a sleeping bag and poking him in the ribs with his gun. And I'm sure I think it was me. So it was interesting to see afterwards.
But you were then stuck with no water or food?
No, we got jumped out of our sleeping bags with, which was nothing. But we had got our boots on, luckily. We hadn't removed them. And we had, it was winter times, and we had some rudiments of military clothing, battle dress, top, and probably a pair of shorts, I can't remember now. We had to wait until sunset, until it got dark, and then started moving off. We knew that if we got about 100 miles along to the west, to Tazur, we could, with luck, it might be in French hands. We thought it would be in French hands. So we had a long walk.
But you walked 100 miles?
Yes, it was more than 100 miles. But that was quite a journey too. And of course our shoes felt a bit. And when we got there, we were met some staggering little few steps towards the palm trees. Some African native troops came out, bayonets fixed, and captured us. And there we were in Tazur.
You're listening to Dan Snow's History. We're talking about the birth of the SAS with Mike Sadler. More coming up.
I'm Professor Susanna Lipscomb, and on Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, I'm looking for answers to the big questions about every aspect of life in the early modern period. Like, how did the memory of Anne Boleyn continue to influence the court of her daughter, Elizabeth I? How were fairies brought to life on the Elizabethan stage? And how did the arrival of male-only doctors threaten the lives of women? In other words, not just the Tudors, but most definitely also the Tudors. Twice a week, every week. Subscribe now and follow me on Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, wherever you get your podcasts.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura frames are beautiful, Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It's super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving an Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. And also remember, when using messaging apps, they shrink the photos. You cannot print those out. You cannot blow them up. This is high quality imagery going to one of the most important people in your life. The Aura app is super easy to set up. It takes about 2 minutes and you're going to love it. There's free unlimited storage. Add unlimited photos and videos and invite as many people as you want to a frame. Right now, Aura has got a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting auraframes.com to get $30 plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AURAframes.com. Use code DANSNOW at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
And the French were there.
The French were there, but they had jerrycans full of Algerian wine. So we had a fairly good welcome. But they couldn't keep us. And so later that same night, we were, because they said we were in the American zone and they couldn't accept responsibility for us. So we were carted off up and surrendered to the Americans. That was a funny occasion too, because there was an American war reporter there, whose name I can't. He's written a book I've got here, and he happened to be at the local headquarters, and he spoke French, when the French people explained our situation, he went up to get the local fellow, the local commander from upstairs, and he came down as a squad of soldiers came in. We were there where we were. I was still clutching my goatskin bag, and we were tattered beyond belief. And he came in with a squad of soldiers surrounded the room, and he said, "Have these men covered, Sergeant." There we were. They were all, what a joke. But he decided he couldn't deal with such a heavy responsibility. And he loaded us into an ambulance and sent us off the very same night off up to north Tunisia and to go to the American headquarters. And we were followed by this correspondent, who's written a little description of our arrival in a book of his, one jeep were full of correspondents, including this chap, and another jeep full of armed Americans in case we tried to escape. He couldn't believe, because this was about 100 miles away from the British, from the Eighth Army, which was the other side of the Garbes Gap. So he thought we must be German spies or something.
Well, I'm not surprised. How long did it take you to walk across that huge stretch of desert?
I think it was 3 nights and 4 days, roughly speaking. But we mostly walked at night, partly because it's cooler at night and you conserve the water better, and partly because there was less chance of some unknown people spotting us.
And you'd memorised the map effectively, had you? How did you know where to go?
I knew the lay of the land, sort of thing. There's salt along a lot of Welsh, a lot of salt lakes extending westward from Garbes, out to Tazor, which is 100 miles away, and that there was the salt lakes on the one side, and there were hills on the other side. And I knew that if we followed along the edge of the salt lakes, more or less, we would eventually, or if we did survive, we would eventually get to Tazor. So it didn't call for much navigating. It just called for following what you knew.
And you bet you had a few dates, but no other food at all.
No, just a few dates and some water. Well, there you can live for a long time on dates.
Wow, that is extraordinary. And David Stirling was captured. Did you, when you got back to the Brits, Did you rejoin the...
They sent me back to 8th Army headquarters, and then to the headquarters of General Freiberg and the New Zealand Division, which was leading the march on Agabez. And I was sent to see him because having been through the country, I knew it, and I had a couple of days there with him at his caravan. We talked quite a bit about the going and what I knew, which was not all that much. And he was extremely interested in his son, who I think at that time had been sent to the LRDG. And I didn't know him, but I met the general. So that was an interesting moment. And that was the end of my North Africa, because the war ended in just shortly after that. And by the time I'd been sent back to Cairo, and then I was sent on a parachute course in Palestine because I wasn't really regarded as a proper SAS man, not having done their training and parachuting and all the rest of it. So David, in the meantime, we could hear them. The Germans had bottled up the party in the Wadi because we didn't know they were coming. And we should have done, but we didn't. But had we known, there's nothing we could have done because there was no, you couldn't get the vehicles out of there. And they had an armored car there. Although I couldn't see that, but I could hear it going on down the valley. He was captured, although I think he escaped. I think he escaped in the early days. We were always told that the best chance of escaping was as soon as possible after you were captured. And he certainly did escape, but was recaptured. And then by stages, I think he was in a prison camp in Italy, and then eventually ended up in Colditz. And Dave, and then there was a pause at that stage while getting ready for the invasion into Italy. And by then, I was sent back to the UK to prepare for the next thing. But the trouble is, I never kept any records. And I mean, we weren't supposed to keep records, and some people did, I think, when they had some useful information. But I had no records of any kind, so I've never been able to do anything other than to remember things.
Well, you've got a very good memory. What do you do back in the UK and in preparation for the invasion of Europe?
Well, I went up to Scotland to help with the setting up of a base there, and then doing recruiting to get more people in they wanted to enlarge the SAS by that stage. And there was a big recruiting business. So we were getting new people in, or we were recruiting people and training up in Scotland. And, that was the sort of mainly what we were doing. And then I became an IO, an intelligence officer of sorts, because I was never trained. I wasn't a properly trained soldier, really. And I was doing more of that than training in the end, and planning for what was going to happen in North Africa. So that was my job. And at some stage then, I think it was after I got back from France, I was sent off to America for a lecture tour.
But what about Operation Overlord and beyond? How involved were you in that?
Well, I'm just at the time of D-Day, I was a dispatching officer at that time. I was sending off the little parties, briefing them, and taking them to airfields to drop And so I was supposed to wait at the airfield till the aircraft got back and debrief the crew about what had happened. But I was found that it was possible to get on the aircraft and go and get your own view on what happened. So as a sort of in the second pilot seat, because the Stirling didn't had a second pilot, but they didn't carry a second pilot. So I could usually manage to go out with a dropping party. And so I did that, and then I got the debriefs and reported what happened.
And so you were dropping them. They were parachuting into France and carrying out missions there.
Yes, and then subsequently, Paddy Main, who was by that time commanding the SAS, he was a man who wanted to be there doing something. So, and he wanted me to go with him. So we parachuted into central France sometime after D-Day, this was, because we'd been servicing the people who were there already. And we parachuted in down to the Morvan area. I didn't really exactly know what happened to him. I was deputed to drive from the Morvan Mountains up through France in a jeep with a Newton Jack on the front, not a small one, admittedly, and to the Forest of Orléans to find out what had happened to one of the SAS units that had been dropped in the Forest of Orléans area and had gone off the air. So I was deputed really to go and find them and find out what had happened and restore their communications. So that's what I did.
Were you driving through German-held territory that day?
Oh, yes, all the way. Quite a long... Well, not exactly on the main roads, although had to pass the main road. But no, back ways, basically. I had a mucky fellow who knew the back roads and the jeep. And we drove up.
How did you cope with the constant terror of being captured?
Well, it wears you down a bit in the end, I must admit. As long as you're not, you don't, I don't know. I was pretty shattered by the end of it, I must admit. But still, that was part of the job at the start.
How old were you in 1944?
I would have been 24 by then.
So you're a grizzled veteran by then?
No. Yeah, grizzled, yes, I suppose so.
After the line started to move, as the British and Americans and Canadians allies started to push the Germans back through northern France into Belgium and Holland, were you still on operations?
I think that is when I went on this lecture tour in America, because I didn't have any more active involvement after that. I didn't get into Germany because Paddy got his fourth DSO on that part, but I wasn't with him then. And then the SAS went up to Norway, where they appeared to have rather a jolly time.
Let's just quickly remind everyone that so Blair Main, aka Paddy Main, he was one of the most decorated soldiers of World War II?
Well, he had four DSOs.
Four Distinguished Service Orders.
Yeah, at various different times and through the war.
That's extraordinary.
Mm. Yes, well, he was actually recommended for a VC, but I think that four DSOs was even rarer than a VC.
And then after the war, did you leave the army fairly quickly or did you stay on?
No, I stayed on. Before we were demobbed, I got out early because by that time I was doing an adjutant's job. We were just gathering up to be demobbed down in Chelmsford, and I was doing the adjutant's job, and I got a letter in from the colonial office asking whether there would be any volunteers from the SAS to go on an expedition to the Antarctic. So I took that into Paddy and said, I'm the first volunteer. And he decided he'd like to come as well. So, and another chap volunteered. So we got an early demob and shipped off to the Antarctic.
So I meant to say, I'll quickly go back, that the group of SAS guys you were looking for in the Forest of Orleans, I forgot to ask, did you find them or not?
They'd been ambushed and killed. He was a famous pre-war cartoonist, Ian Fenwick. Yeah, he used to have very good little cartoons in Men Only before the war, and during the war, of course, as well. He did, but by the time he got into the SAS, I think he was a captain then. I'm not quite certain. And he had one of the units that went in after D-Day or about D-Day, and he was in the Forest of Orleans area, and he was operating there. But he was on his way into a local village, I suppose that he, I don't know, he must have known something about it, and he was ambushed just outside the village, and they were all killed.
When the war was over, were you just absolutely overjoyed, or did part of you think, I'll miss the excitement and miss the thrill?
Well, there was a period after the actual war part was over. I was sent back to, as part of the war, in the war crimes department, to look into what had happened to one of the patrols. In fact, it turned out that it was a patrol that I had been in an aircraft that had dropped them, and that had been actually compromised, and they fell into the hands of the Gestapo, who had organized the dropping zone. And on our way back from that one, we were attacked by a night fighter. So, that, you know, one realized it had all gone wrong, because they were attacked. The pilot said that as we crossed the DZ, he had found a lot of turbulence, which was, I think, the other aircraft had been doing a ready flight. And as we climbed up out of the thing, an ME-110 attacked us. So that was yet another experience, which was a bit alarming at the time.
But when the war was over, was it sheer relief, or do you think part of you missed it?
Well, by then I was in the Antarctic. That was a different experience. Well, I missed the desert. I missed a bit of the excitement and the chaps, the friends and things that one had made. But because the war went on, you know, I went on from there and did other things.
And now, are you the last of the long-range desert group /SAS, do you think, surviving from the war?
I should. Well, there's an LRDG chap surviving, certainly, because he will be, I just heard a couple of days ago that he will certainly be at the LRDG reunion, which I'm hoping to go to, which is, I think, on the 7th of next month. No, not sure about that. Yeah, I think it's early next month anyway. And, that's it. There are two or three other people. I don't think there are any who were yes, I think there is one who was in the desert, Jack Mann. I'm not sure what happened to him. I saw him a couple of years ago. But he may still be alive, I think there may be one or two others that I don't know about.
Well, it's been a great honour. Thank you very much for talking to me today. Thank you for taking the time.
Well, I shall be interested to know what you do with it.
Thank you. We're all looking to make more sustainable choices, but making your own shoes out of natural materials could pose a few challenges. The twigs and leaves in your yard aren't exactly comfortable, and while mud does perfectly contour the feet, it doesn't score high on the durability front. But thanks to Allbirds, you can skip all the backyard experimentation. At the Allbirds Innovation Lab, they're doing all the sciencey stuff like research and testing to create shoes from natural, sustainable materials. And their innovative processes mean using less of the bad stuff and more of the good, while making shoes unlike any other. Like the Plant Pacer, made with 100% plastic-free plant leather. The Tree Dasher, a running shoe made from eucalyptus tree fiber. And from Sugarcane, they've made the Superlight, their lightest shoe ever by weight and carbon footprint. It's not rocket science, it's shoe science. Allbirds is making shoes better than natural. They're supernatural. Find your perfect pair at Allbirds.com today. That's Allbirds.com.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dan Snow's History It. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us and you'll be doing us a big favour. Don't forget you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of TV documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code DANSNOW at checkout.